Well, I'll get my main subject to you in a moment, but first, liberals want to merge the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts together. They say it's because girls can't become Eagle Scouts, but why not? Simply create a path to Eagle Scout among the girls. Eagles do come in both genders. First, it was allowing gay scoutmasters to camp with young boys in the woods. Now, not all gay scoutmasters would molest those boys, but not all Muslims are terrorists either. It only takes one. Next, the shame on George W. Bush for his comments that centered on Donald Trump. For 8 excruciatingly long years, George Bush stayed silent while Barack Obama followed his pledge to bring America down. While Black Lives Matter and Antifa arose to create havoc in America under Barack Obama, George Bush remained silent. While Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton, and the Clinton Foundation took in money from Russia, while Hillary, as Secretary of State, was signing off on a deal to give Russia 20% of America's uranium, George W. Bush remained silent. Now he insinuates that the racial divide and the violence in America might be attributable to Donald Trump. Bush ignores the fact that for 8 long years, Obama presided over the most racial divide in history. And while Black Lives Matter and Antifa increased their violence on this country, Obama allowed it to continue and Bush remained silent. Donald Trump has been in office for only 9 months. To even pretend that what we have now in our streets and universities was created by Trump is dishonest, and Bush should be ashamed of himself. If Jeb Bush had won the Republican primary, Hillary Clinton would be president today. Since Jeb lost to Trump, George Bush has finally unleashed his inner anger. Now, I regret helping get George Bush elected through support, my vote, and money. He now has shown himself to be as petty as Obama and Hillary Clinton. Now, I'll get to my subject on Venezuela in a moment, and please do listen, because what's happening in Venezuela has serious repercussions for us here in the United States. But even a blind person can see the objective of liberals and career Democrats. That objective is to keep negative fake news about Donald Trump in the headlines to make people believe that their witch hunts are real. The fake news media picks up every little bit of hate and amplifies it. The latest incident was when a loudmouthed, self-professed Trump hater named Frederica Wilson, who's a congresswoman from Florida, went to the willing press with accusations that President Trump had called the mother of a fallen soldier and been disrespectful to her. This evil woman has tried every tactic to create fake news about Trump since before he was even sworn into office. She argued that the president told the mother of the fallen soldier that he knew what he was getting into, and it was still a shame that he lost his life. Frederica and the others say that it was Trump's tone of voice. But another grieving mother has released a tape of the call that President Trump made to her. Listen to the tone of that and see if you find it objectionable. The mother, who Frederica Wilson is using in this, said that the call from Trump made her cry. Listen, you're coming home from the funeral of your son. The President of the United States calls you. That's enough to cry. But even if it's true, and there is evidence that this woman is a liar, what the words that Trump said mean to me is that this brave soldier knew what his job entailed and the danger that went with it. But he kept that fear aside to serve his country. That made him a hero. The addled congresswoman also said that the president referred to the soldier as your guy, as if that was disrespectful. He was her guy. Now, this whole nasty mess is meant to keep negative news about Donald Trump alive. Frederica Wilson is a black woman representing a district where the color of her skin means more than the content of her character. She is a clownish buffoon, not unlike Maxine Waters and Sheila Jackson Lee, who also remain in Congress due to the color of their skin and certainly not the content of their character. Now, last week on the ABC Evening News, David Muir said there were questions about the attack in Niger, and that some question whether or not the four soldiers who died there had the intelligence to be able to get out. Think about that. Was Muir saying that the soldiers were not intelligent enough to get out? If we go by career Democrat standards, we can easily assume that's what he meant. But if we use common sense, what Muir meant was that the soldiers may not have had proper military intelligence gathering by our government to know how to get out. If we use that common sense, then we know that the president, any president, does not make calls to a grieving mother to disrespect her. Like the Muir incident, Frederica Wilson used no common sense. And if her history is any indication, she has none. In that same vein, the fake news media has made a mountain out of a molehill about what President Trump said about Puerto Rico. What he said was that the United States would get the job done in Puerto Rico's hurricane relief efforts. But, he said, FEMA and our troops could not stay there forever. Career Democrats and the fake news media rose up in indignation. How dare the president say that FEMA and our troops would not stay in Puerto Rico forever? And how ignorant is their fake indignation? Why would they say such ignorant things? It's because the sole objective of the career Democrats and fake news media is to keep negative thoughts, real or not, in the headlines. Even the most strident Democrat would not dare say that we should keep FEMA and our troops there forever. Can we not see how contrived that entire episode is? If Trump had said that we would keep FEMA and our troops there forever, guess which party and which fake news outlets would have risen up in indignation? Now, these things are important because too many in America just look at headlines and not for the truth in a story. They form negative opinions about this president based on the negative fake news. Journalism in America is not dead. Truth in journalism is dead. While America slept, our schools and universities were cranking out biased liberal journalism graduates who now man the news desks and the printing presses. They were taught well by a cadre of so-called professors who are liberal to their core. They were the radicals in the 60s themselves, railing against America, and they have turned out clones to carry their anger forward. Newspapers are dying in America because of their liberalism. Network news is losing viewers faster than Speedy Gonzales. One last thought on this subject. Can anyone listening to me explain why Republicans who are in power have not moved forward to demand an investigator to look into the corruption of the Obama administration? The dishonesty of Eric Holder and Loretta Lynch? The pay-for-play schemes of the Clintons that resulted in Russia getting 20% of our uranium stores and the Clinton Foundation getting more than $140 million from Russian sources after Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, signed off on giving the Russians 20% of our uranium. Why Russian sources then doubled Bill Clinton's speaking fee to $500,000 for one speech? We can't blame the lack of oversight in these matters on Democrats. Republicans control the White House, the Senate, and the House of Representatives. They have the power to demand that Attorney General Jeff Sessions have the FBI investigating the Obama's administration's corruption and the Clintons' part in it, as diligently as the investigation of collusion between Trump and Russia during the election. As it stands now, Davy Mueller's investigation has chewed up millions of taxpayer dollars and unearthed not one shred of evidence of a Trump-Russia collusion. Meanwhile, Mueller has been casting a wide net to try and find any dirt on Trump, rather than sticking to his original appointment to look into a Trump-Russian collusion. Only now, after more than a year of negative fake news about Trump, has Congress slowly begun to seek answers from Democrats. Republicans were the problem on that one. Secondly, we're now seeing the myths about Hollywood exposed. While Harvey Weinstein is at the center of it, coming days will see major actors, producers, and directors ousted as rapists, abusers, and pedophiles. The same liberal industry that was so fond of pretending that they should be the moral compass of America has shown that morals in Hollywood are fewer than lips on a chicken. I hope you'll listen carefully today to what's happening in Venezuela and how it affects you and the United States. For one thing, socialism is making a comeback in our country because of people like Bernie Sanders, an openly avowed socialist, and a host of left-wingers who have hijacked the Democratic Party. At the end of my report on Venezuela, I'll explain how all of this affects the United States. There's always little side effects to socialism that are blamed for the effects of actual socialism. They'll always say that Soviet Russia was corrupt. There's always some excuse as to why their socialist philosophy isn't paying off this time, even though there's no examples of it actually paying off for anyone ever, which is kind of a problem when your philosophy has no examples of success. My research for this week's commentary drew facts from an Atlantic Monthly expose on Venezuela's failed socialism. Their experiment with 21st century socialism, as introduced by the late President Hugo Chavez, a self-described champion of the poor who vowed to distribute the country's wealth among the masses, and instead steered the nation toward the catastrophe the world is witnessing under his hand-picked successor, Maduro. It's been a cruel failure. Developing countries, like teenagers, are prone to accidents. One pretty much expects them to suffer an economic crash, a political crisis, or both, with some regularity. The news coming from Venezuela, including shortages, as well as, most recently, riots over blackouts, the imposition of a 2-day work week for government employees, supposedly aimed at saving electricity, and an accelerating drive to recall the president is dire, but also easy to dismiss as representing just one more of those recurrent episodes. That would be a mistake. What Venezuela is going through is monstrously unique. It is nothing less than the collapse of a large, wealthy, seemingly modern, seemingly democratic nation, just a few hours' flight from the United States. In the last 2 years, Venezuela has experienced the kind of implosion that hardly ever occurs in a middle-income country like it outside of war. Mortality rates are skyrocketing there. One public service after another is collapsing. Triple-digit inflation has left more than 70% of the population in poverty. An unimaginable crime wave keeps people locked indoors at night. Shoppers have to stand in line for hours to buy basic food. Babies die in large numbers for lack of simple, inexpensive medicines and equipment in hospitals, as do the elderly and those suffering from chronic illnesses. But why? It's not that the country lacked money. Sitting atop the world's largest reserves of oil at the tail end of the frenzied oil boom, the government led first by Chavez and since 2013 by Maduro received over $1 trillion in oil revenues over the past 17 years. It faced virtually no institutional constraints on how to spend that unprecedented bonanza. It's true now that oil prices have since fallen, a risk many people foresaw, and one that the government had made no provision for. But that can hardly explain what's happened. Venezuela's garish implosion began well before the price of oil plummeted. Back in 2014, when oil was still trading north of $100 a barrel, Venezuelans were already facing acute shortages of basic things like bread and toiletries. The real culprit is Chavismo, the ruling philosophy named for Chavez and carried forward by Maduro, and its truly breathtaking propensity for mismanagement. The government plowed state money into foolish investments, institutional destruction, as Chavez and Maduro became more authoritarian and crippled the country's democratic institutions. Nonsense policymaking like price and currency controls, and plain thievery as corruption has proliferated among the unaccountable officials and their friends and families. In case in point, price controls, which have expanded to apply to more and more goods, food and vital medicines, but also car batteries, essential medical services, deodorant, diapers, and of course, toilet paper. The goal was to check inflation and keep goods affordable for the public and the poor. But anyone with a basic grasp of economics could have foreseen the consequences. When prices are set below what it costs to produce it, sellers can't afford to keep their shelves stocked. Officials, prices are low. But it's a mirage. The products have disappeared. Venezuela's desperate citizens are eating zoo animals and rats to stay alive. When a state is in the process of collapse, dimensions of decay feed back on each other in an intractable cycle. Populist giveaways, for example, have fed the country's ruinous flirtation with hyperinflation. The International Monetary Fund now estimates that prices in Venezuela will rise by 2,200% in 2017. The government practically gives away gasoline for free, even after having raised the price earlier this year. As a result of this and similar policies, the state is chronically short of funds, forcing it to print even more money to finance its spending. Consumers, flush with cash and chasing a dwindling supply of goods, are caught in a deadly inflationary cycle. There are many theories about the deeper forces that have destroyed Venezuela's economy, torn apart its society, and devastated its institutions, but their result is ultimately a human tragedy, representing one of the most severe humanitarian crises facing the Western Hemisphere. Here's a glimpse of what it's like for some of the individuals who are living the collapse and seeing nobody held accountable. Finding the basic requirements of daily life has become the main preoccupation of Venezuelan families, and it can be a matter of life and death. At 14 years old, Mikel Mancilla had been battling epilepsy for 6 years. His condition was under control, thanks to a common anticonvulsant prescription drug. It had long been a struggle for his family to get this drug, but as the gap between the real cost of the drugs and the maximum that pharmacies were allowed to charge for them grew, it became impossible to find the drug. On February 11, 2016, Mikhail's mother, Yamaris, gave him the last tablet in their house. None of Yamaris' usual pharmacies had any anticonvulsants in stock. She worked social media, which in Venezuela these days is filled with desperate people trying to get sparse medicines, but no luck. In the following days, Mikhail experienced a series of increasingly violent epileptic seizures as his family watched helplessly. On February 20, 2016, the boy suffered respiratory failure and died. There, but for the grace of God, go our own children. But Mikhail's case is not unique. The collapse of the healthcare system and the scarcity of medicine is costing lives every day. Psychiatric patients struggling with schizophrenia have to go without antipsychotic medicines. Tens of thousands of HIV-positive people struggle to find the antiretrovirals that they need forcing them into a kind of stop-and-go treatment pattern that doctors warn risk bringing on full-blown AIDS. Cancer patients can't find chemotherapy drugs. Even malaria, which had essentially disappeared from Venezuela a generation ago, is easily treatable with inexpensive medicines, but it's making a deadly comeback because the medicines are not available. While Venezuelans are dying from lack of simple, inexpensive pills, their radical socialist government was spending tens of millions of dollars a year to keep a native son, a man named Pastor Maldonado, competing in Formula One global racing. Venezuela's oil largesse has been scattered around the globe from the $18 million handed to the American actor Danny. This is $18 million that they gave to the American actor Danny Glover in 2007 to produce an ideologically appropriate film. It still has not been delivered. To the millions of Venezuelan dollars spent financing leftist parties and movements from El Salvador to Argentina to Spain and beyond. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan government can no longer afford even rudimentary law and order, making Caracas, the capital, one of the most dangerous cities in the world. Drug traffickers run large sections of the countryside. Prison gang leaders keep military-style weapons on hand, and while grenade attacks still make the news, they are nothing new. The breakdown of law and order is so severe that even children are being robbed. At Nuestra Señora del Carmen School in El Cortijo, a struggling neighborhood of Caracas, supplies for the school lunch program have been stolen twice this year already. Thugs have broken into the school's pantry late at night after fresh food was delivered. The second burglary meant the school cannot afford to feed its children for at least a week. Elsewhere, school food programs have simply stopped working because the government cannot keep them supplied. In poorer communities, parents often respond by taking their children out of school. They are more useful standing in long lines outside of grocery stores than sitting in a classroom. The regime has long put education at the center of its propaganda, yet the reality today is that a generation of underprivileged children are being denied an education through straightforward hunger. Still, some politicians seem to have found the bright side of their children's hunger. The opposition-controlled National Assembly alleges that government officials or their cronies stole some $200 billion in food import scams alone since 2003. In the midst of all of this, Venezuela is facing one of the worst Zika outbreaks in South America, and it's an epidemic the country can hardly measure, much less respond to. Venezuela's Institute for Tropical Medicine is where the crime and public health crisis collides. The institute, which is ground zero in the country's response to tropical epidemics, was burglarized a shocking 11 times in the first 2 months of 2016, and the break-ins have continued. This has left the lab without a single microscope. Burglars rampaged through the lab, scattering samples of highly dangerous viruses and toxic fungal spores into the air. Conditions like those make it virtually impossible for institute researchers to do their work, crippling the country's response to the Zika outbreak. And attempts to repair the damage are undercut by the same dysfunctions that afflict the rest of the economy. There's just no money to replace the expensive imported equipment of criminals that has been stolen. Other aspects of state collapse feed back on the Zika crisis as well. Venezuela's city's water infrastructure is crumbling after nearly two decades of neglect. That would be hard in the best of times, but last year's El Nino brought an acute drought to most of the country. Water utilities have responded to falling reservoir levels with harsh water rationing measures. Neighborhoods and shantytowns can go for days and even weeks with no clean water. Most people adapt by filling several buckets when service is provided in preparation for the dry periods. Of course, storing water in buckets is precisely what you should not do when facing a mosquito-borne epidemic. The containers double as breeding grounds for the bugs that transmit the Zika virus, as well as others like malaria. The same drought that's forcing water rationing has seen water levels at the country's electricity-generating dams fall alarmingly. Blackouts used to at least spare the capital. But these days, it's nationwide, as the public utilities struggle to keep enough water in the reservoirs to prevent a complete collapse of the power grid. It didn't have to be that way. Since 2009, hundreds of millions of dollars have been devoted to building new diesel and natural gas-powered plants. The new plants were meant specifically to relieve pressure from the aging hydroelectric network. Much of the capacity never came online, though, and the money was never accounted for. Two people have been indicted over this in the United States, but nobody in Venezuela appears to be even investigating. This is emblematic of the kind of impunity that reigns now at every level of that state government, from the gravest crimes to the highest government offices. On March 4, 2016, 28 miners disappeared in the jungle near Brazil, and eyewitnesses alleged a massacre. Only four people were ever arrested, and they weren't the culprits. They were family members of the victims who dared to call for justice. Late last year, two of the First Lady's nephews, including one who grew up in the presidential household, were arrested by DEA agents in a sting operation, in which they were allegedly recorded offering to provide a large amount of cocaine to agents posing as traffickers. The First Lady's reaction was to accuse the DEA of kidnapping her nephews. Following Venezuela closely means hearing any number of stories like those. The happy, hopeful stage of Venezuela's experiment with Chavez's 21st century socialism is a fading memory. What's been left is a visibly failing state that still leans hard on left-wing rhetoric in a doomed bid to maintain some shred of legitimacy. A country that used to attract fellow travelers and admirers in serious numbers, now holds a fascination for rubberneckers, stunned outsiders, enthralled by the spectacle of a country's collapse. Now, here are four reasons why the turmoil in Venezuela has repercussions in the United States. The world's largest oil reserves are in Venezuela, and any disruption in that supply would surely rattle global energy and financial markets. That could send U.S. gas prices higher and Wall Street stock prices lower. Secondly, the United States is Venezuela's largest customer. We get around 750,000 barrels of oil a day from Venezuela. Venezuela also imports refined products from the United States. As USA Today reported, Venezuela's economic problems, rising unemployment, sky-high inflation, and shortages of basic goods, have unleashed a flood of refugees seeking to enter the United States. A record 18,155 people applied for asylum in 2016, more than any other country. This year, 8,300 people have already applied for asylum, nearly double the number of last year, just four decades ago, and the United States has been a major player in spreading democracy in Latin America. Retrenchment in Venezuela threatens to spread to other countries there with recent anti-U.S. leaders such as Ecuador and Bolivia. As his confrontation with the United States grows, Venezuelan president and dictator Nicolas Maduro has moved to improve economic ties with other governments that have strained or hostile relations with the United States, including Cuba, Russia, and China. Keep your eyes on Venezuela's crisis. It could well affect all of us.